From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. In the age of globalism, some Eastern economies are booming. India and China threaten to surpass the U.S. as the leading economic superpower. And the sweep of information technology and consumerism is commingling with ancient forms of the world's oldest religions, like Hinduism, Islam, and Buddhism. Some spiritual traditions are disappearing. Others are going strong.
I mean, it makes sort of Woodstock look like a Rotarian's dinner. 25,000 tantrics all singing, smoking dope, and screeching at each other at the same time.
Travel writer William Dalrymple on a recent gathering of bowl singers in India. More of him in a moment. Also, a Buddhist atheist rejects the place of doctrines like karma and rebirth in Buddhism. And sacred hip-hop.
You know, when you go to a hip-hop concert, you know, the MC or the DJ often goes, say ho, ho. And so we just kind of flip it and we say, say om.
We talk with MC Yogi later this hour. Travel writer William Dalrymple moved to India in 1989. Since then, he's been on hand to witness the explosion of the Indian economy and the cultural changes that have followed in its wake. In his new book called Nine Lives, Dalrymple goes in search of the sacred in modern India. He began by reading the story of two bowl singers, wandering minstrels, who struck up an unlikely friendship. Bowls believe there is no afterlife, no God in heaven, only the God found in each man and woman. They practice esoteric teachings on breathing, sex, philosophy, and mysticism.
The Baals that I write about are Kanai, who's a blind Dalit from the lowest of the low in the Bengal social hierarchy, and his friend Debu, who was the son of a Brahmin, so from the very top of the Bengali village pyramid, if you like. And they became friends, having met one day by accident in a train carriage where they were both busking. And they stayed together and became a sort of spiritual brothers wandering the roads of India. And I just read a short passage about the one time that they actually left each other's company. There was only one time when I left him for an extended period, said Debu. This was when I became obsessed with trying to live without food, like the saints and the yogis in the old stories. These saints controlled all their desires and so never ate. They lived on air alone. I wanted to find out if this was still possible, so I went off on my own and I found a wood apple tree in a forest near a pond. We believe these trees are very auspicious. I sat there in a loincloth and meditated for 2 years, eating less and less until I stopped eating altogether, taking a vow that no food would pass my lips until I reached my goal and achieved enlightenment. I don't know how I lived. I had matted dreadlocks down to my knees, and I sat there not eating, not smoking, drinking nothing but water. I focused inwards, conserving my energies, and I sat there like that through 2 monsoons and 2 cold winters. I used to visit him, said Kanai. The villagers knew where he was and would lead me to him through the forest. They called him Bel Tala Babaji, the sadhu who sits under the wood apple tree. He was very thin and very weak. He hardly moved or talked, only very short sentences. I was very anxious that he wouldn't survive, and it pained me that he wouldn't eat. I bought him food, but he refused to eat it. He was very determined. I don't know what I attained with this penance, said Debu, but I know that my mind was at peace, as never before. My hair was matted, but the knots of my heart were untied. After a certain point, I stopped feeling hunger. I was at the end of desire, beyond the senses. It was then that I started hallucinating. I was no longer living inside my body. I was somewhere outside of myself in a state of ecstasy and rapture. I've never felt anything like it before or since. And then one cold, starry night around the time of Makar Sankranti, I felt suddenly lost, as if my mind had finally detached itself from my body. Like a bird flying high. It was Kanai who brought me back. What do you mean? Well, I was unaware of it, but there had been a terrible storm. Kanai had a premonition that I was in trouble and came over from Tarapit to see if I was all right. He arrived early in the morning with a group of villagers and found me up to my neck in a pool of mud, fast asleep. They all thought I was dead, and I suppose I almost was. Kanai brought me back to his house in Tarapit and nursed me back to health. The blind man saved the man who could see, said Kanai, chuckling to himself. Sometimes the mad and the sightless can understand things better and more clearly than the sane and the sighted. The blind, said Debu, are never deceived by appearances. Maybe, said Kanai, it is only those of us who have no eyes who can see through the lure of Maya and glimpse reality for what it is.
It's an extraordinary story. This is a story that is almost out of a different time. It's not 21st century Earth at all.
Yes, in part. Certainly the passage I read you could have been a Byzantine monk holed up in a hollow tree in the Levant in the 5th century, or some sort of Christian mystic like Julian of Norwich living in a hermitage in medieval England, or equally it could be from some Mahabharata or some ancient Indian folktale. But a lot of these lies continue. And what Nine Lives is about is the way that the ancient and the eternal, these extraordinary, profound philosophies that have developed in India, are increasingly being shot through with elements of modernity. The sadhus who wander the roads of India now wander past thundering trucks heading off to software centres and places where people are doing your bank accounts or booking your plane fares when you think you're actually talking down the street in New York at some back office in Bangalore. And it's not the urban centres that I've written about in this book, nor the unchanging India of the village. It is these places, which means most of India, which are suspended between modernity and tradition. In a halfway point, it's a report from the front line of the change that's overwhelming India in this extraordinary manner at the moment.
You know, this is what we hear about in this country, the India that is in competition with the United States, the India that is supposed to bypass the economy of America within the next 40 or 50 years. We hear about all those changes, and yet reading your Nine Lives and the multiple other lives that you can't include, there seems to be a huge swath of the population in India that isn't a part of that economy, the one that we read about in the papers every day.
Well, yes and no. I mean, at one level, you're quite correct. I think the Indian economic model is a very undemocratic one, despite the fact that India is a great, the world's largest democracy. China's development is being powered by mass economic empowerment. You know, the huge industrial plants where large numbers of people are being employed. And that's the kind of basis of the economic miracle in China. In India, it's a far more elitist thing. There are these brilliant computer geeks and boffins and people that speaking perfect English. A far smaller number of people are earning a far larger amount of money than is the case in China. So on one hand, you're right, it is a tiny proportion of the population that's engaged in this. On the other hand, modernity and the new India and the things that are changing touch the most surprising and remote and exotic corners of India. I mean, to give you one example, in the course of my research, I'd read an article by a professor of comparative religion about an extraordinary-sounding tantric who lived in Bengal. And this guy, who was called Tapan Goswami, was supposed to have the largest collection of skulls in India, and he used these skulls for his tantric magic. He would summon the spirits of the former inhabitants of the skulls and, as he believed, tame them with his magic. So I went and saw this guy, and we eventually found him, and it was like some scene from sort of, you know, Indiana Jones or some sort of fevered Orientalist fantasy from some Gothic novel. Tapan Goswami was there with his goat, which he was about to slaughter. The goat was tethered to a trident. Tapan was sharpening his sword in preparation for the sacrifice to the goddess. A mist was rising off the lake. And, you know, it was, as it, straight out of sort of, you know, Rider Haggard or something. And yet, you know, you talk to this guy and I said, is it true? And he said, absolutely, I've got this fantastic collection of skulls. And he chatted away a bit and then he sort of clammed up. And I said, go on, you can tell me. I won't tell anyone. And he said, well, you know, it's not you I'm worried about. It's my two boys. They're ophthalmologists in New Jersey. And they keep saying, Dad, you've got to stop going on about this black magic. It's getting a really bad name for us out here. Yeah. So even there, even in the kind of the furthest extremes of sort of Indiana Jones orientalist fantasy, which, you know, it is there because it does exist in part. Even there, with the false skull feeders, you know, the Indian diaspora, the new India pops up. There's another time when I was walking in the Himalayas. High, high, high in the Himalayas. Gorgeous summer day, trekking up into the mountains. And this naked Naga sadhu came bounding up the hill, walking far faster and far fitter than I was. And he was almost completely naked, but for a blanket and a heavy trident that he was carrying on his shoulder, the symbol of Lord Shiva. And we fell in with each other, and I began talking to him. And it turned out he actually spoke English, which itself was a surprise, because you wouldn't expect a holy man necessarily to have any English. And he had really good English. And even more surprising, it turned out, in fact, he was an MBA. And he'd become a sadhu after a 10 years of selling white goods, fridges and kitchen appliances for a consumer electricals company called Kelvinator in Bombay. So, you know, the old India is there, but it often is more surprising and more complex than one might imagine or indeed even wish.
You have watched with great intensity the lives of these people and of others. You talk about the coexistence now. Having met all of these people, having heard their stories, do you think that this kaleidoscopic version of religion and spirituality that's in India now will persist? Or is the modern world going to sweep it away? Will it wash away as the globe tightens, as everybody comes together?
I think there's several things to be said in answer to that. First of all, I think the globalization that people talk about can be hugely exaggerated. The world isn't flat, whatever Thomas Friedman says. While I'm now wearing a pair of Nikes and people will be wearing exactly the same pair of shoes in Saigon, in Singapore, in Siberia, the things going on in the minds of the people wearing those Nikes are still going to be as different as they ever have been. As something like 9/11 showed us, we may think we know the world. We may think we can go on our laptop and look at Google Earth and see a street in Afghanistan as easily as we can see a street in New York. But the reality is that we don't know the world. There are huge areas of the world we don't understand at all. But is this all going to die out? The answer is that some forms are dying out. The small gods in the villages are giving way to the national gods. In the same way, in Islam, the small Sufi shrines which dot South Asia, and the common people go and pray at the saint shrine, they tie a thread through a lattice and ask for a child or a job for the man or exam results for the children or whatever it is. These are giving way to, in Islam, to a more sort of homogenized, textual, reformed Islam. Often of a more sort of Wahhabi nature, more puritanical nature, rather like Reformation Christianity replacing the Catholicism of the Middle Ages. And on the other hand, there are other religious groupings that I write about. I went to the Kanduli Mela, which is the big annual gathering of the Baals, and I mean, it makes sort of Woodstock look like a Rotarian's dinner. 25,000 tantrics all singing, smoking dope and screeching at each other at the same time. It's a fabulous fair. Yeah. And that seemed this year to be busier than it's ever been. And more and more tantrics screeching than ever before.
William Dalrymple is the author of Nine Lives, In Search of the Sacred in Modern India. Tibetans everywhere are celebrating the 75th birthday of their spiritual and political leader, the 14th Dalai Lama, the man who's championed their cause and helped spread Buddhism around the world. But as the Dalai Lama ages, many have begun to wonder what will happen to the 150,000 Tibetans living in exile when their leader dies. Increasingly, the answer depends on how the countries where Tibetan refugees live respond to growing political pressure from China. Last October, and again in March, reporter Greg Bruno traveled to India and Nepal to investigate how Chinese influence is shaping the lives of Tibetans far away from their ancestral homeland, which is under Beijing's control. He filed this story.
The climb to Pasang's meditation retreat is, quite literally, breathtaking. Eagles soar in the cool, dry air, and sheep graze on tufts of grass, clinging to the snowy Himalayan foothills. It's a warm, sunny day in the Indian village of Dharamsala, and from up here, a mile above the Kanger Valley, the Tibetans' long struggle with China seems an afterthought. Instead, it's precisely what Pasang reflects on.
I'm a very small Buddhist follower. I have no ideas of big thinking, but I try to always practice Buddha Dharma. I hope to expose Buddha Dharma all over the world.
Pasang sits in the corner of a small, dark cave tucked among some pine trees. Sunlight from a single window illuminates his saffron robes, and his long black hair betrays his status as a lay follower, not a monk. Pasang's journey is as unlikely as his appearance. For 6 years, he served in the All-Tibetan Security Force within the Indian Army, training to use guns to take his country back from China. That was a decade ago, and today Pasang is training his mind to focus on compassion for his enemies, not violence. But even after 9 years of meditating, he admits Buddhism might not be Tibet's best hope. Like many young Tibetans, Pasang is frustrated with China's refusal to seriously negotiate, and he says the day may come when he's willing to ditch his robes and again take up arms.
Yeah, definitely angry. Angry. Younger generation Tibetan people have this. All want war. Frustration. A lot of frustration.
Dharamsala is the heart of Tibetan exile. When I first came here 10 years ago, I found that people shared a common vision for Tibet's future. Trust the Dalai Lama, and one day Tibet will be free, or at the very least, sovereign. In many ways, what China did or didn't do was of little consequence to these refugees. But after 5 decades in exile, and with few signs that Beijing is willing to budge on its One China policy, Tibetans here are getting restless. Many accuse China of pressuring them to give up their traditions and their dreams of independence. For Tibetans in exile, China seems to be everywhere.
This is television from the Tibet Autonomous Region based in Lhasa. And this one in Chinese comes from, you know, this Amto, what the Chinese call Qinghai province, and most probably from the provincial capital, Sinan.
Tupten Sampil is the chief spokesman for the Tibetan government in exile. He says Chinese propaganda is now as close as the knob on one's television set.
Well, the life in Tibet, I mean, they portray it as, you know, this happy, singing, dancing minorities who are blessed by the, you know, this Chinese communist rule. I mean, there's no negative news at all. Even the weather seems sunny and no wind.
I'd been hearing about China's growing influence on Tibetans in exile for a number of years. So I went to several Tibetan communities in Indian Nepal to see for myself. I wondered how China's influence machine was operating beyond Beijing's borders. Sampil sums up what I found.
China is increasing its criticism, allegations, and accusations against His Holiness the Dalai Lama and the Tibetan administration here.
In Dharamsala last fall, I asked the Dalai Lama whether he's alarmed by the stepped-up criticism and pressure from China.
Of course, obviously. I said the totalitarian regime sort of pressure everywhere, even in the United States also. So I think both India and Nepal receiving some special blessing from Peking. That's quite clear. But then the situation overall in Nepal, not very settled, not very sort of stable. So a lot of problems. So the Chinese pressure, Chinese communist pressure, is more effective. Like that.
As the Dalai Lama suggests, India has been able to deflect some of this pressure. That's not the case in Nepal, home to the world's second largest concentration of Tibetan refugees. During the week of March 10th, the day Tibetans everywhere commemorate their failed 1959 uprising against the People's Republic of China, Nepali police fanned out across the capital, Kathmandu, to enforce bans on public protests. During a gathering at the famed Bodhinath Stupa, I watched truncheon-wielding police in riot gear push and drag Tibetan refugees off to jail. Dozens of Tibetans were arrested just for shouting anti-Chinese slogans. In one baton charge I witnessed, the thwack of bamboo sticks could be heard slapping across the backs of saffron-clad monks and teenagers. Nepal doesn't hide what it's doing. Anti-China activities are not permitted on Nepali soil. But restrictions go beyond free speech. Many younger Tibetans in Nepal have no papers to work legally. They can't travel abroad either. The analysts I spoke to blame China for this crackdown.
So Nepal government is like this. One eye close, one eye open. And Tibetan issue is a big bargain for them. During the last 2 years, the Chinese officials are very much coming here, paying visit every time, promising so many things like hydro power, roads. These all are due to the Tibetan issue, the bargain they have.
Tashi Punstok is a member of the Tibetan Youth Congress, one of the most outspoken youth groups advocating for full Tibetan independence. When I called him the day before the protests, he insisted we talk in secret, on top of a nondescript hotel in a heavily populated part of Kathmandu. He said he worried spies might be watching him.
In Kathmandu, if you are organizing rallies, we have to get permission from the authorities. But we organize without the permission. Because if we go to ask for permission, they won't allow us. So sometimes we clash with the police. And we have to talk, negotiate, then again cancel the program.
So getting arrested, though, is no big deal?
When we protest, like, if you get arrested, 10 to 15 people, then the police will harass you, they will beat you very badly. If you are arrested, like, around 100 to 50 people, they don't have space to keep that much detainee inside Nepal. They'll keep you on the football pitch ground, because they cannot hold this much. And we are also not allowed food, water, by the Nepalese authority.
Tashi Punstok is just a few years out of high school, but political pressure is also hitting even younger Tibetans. At one Tibetan school I visited, students had been told not to sing their national anthem. The request was made by Nepal's Maoist Party, believed to have close ties to China's leadership. But when I talked to Jampa Punstok, the longtime principal of the school, I discovered that rules meant possibly to placate China aren't always followed.
So they say, the Maoists say, you can't sing the Tibetan national anthem, you only can sing the Nepali national anthem?
Yeah. This is a native, not allowed to two national anthem. Just so only singing the one national anthem.
Do you listen to that?
No. Now we do the two national anthem that we do there. No listen.
Attention! Tibetan national anthem, begin!
Hearing Tibet's national anthem, it's clear that not all Tibetans are giving up their dream of a free Tibet, despite China's steady encroachment into their daily lives in exile. Some remain optimistic, but others want to take a more active role in resisting China. Back up the mountain inside his meditation cave, Pasang is struggling with such passive resolve. One day, he says, China's long shadow might cause him to snap. He switches to Tibetan to explain his feelings.
It's natural when somebody forcefully takes your country back and occupies it, and even does harm to the people. It's natural that everybody will feel angry. In future, now I'm not totally devoted to Buddhism.
And
War? I'm ready for war. Not totally decided to Buddha disciple. This freedom, I really want freedom.
Everyone wants freedom.
Our story about Tibetan exiles was produced by Greg Bruno, a staff writer for the Council on Foreign Relations. Research support for the story was provided by the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute. Thanks also to Champa Kedu for his translation. Coming up, sacred hip-hop. I'm Jim Fleming. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Today's hip-hop often concerns itself with the realities of everyday life. But the self-expression and energy in the form are continuing to evolve. The latest incarnation is a young artist changing the face of devotional music in America. MC Yogi combines hip-hop and rap with Indian spirituality and chanting in his new album, Elephant Power. The title is an homage to the Indian elephant god Ganesh. MC Yogi told Ann Strangechamps what life was like for him before he discovered yoga.
Well, you know, I used to be a graffiti artist, and I ended up in jail a couple times and got arrested and, you know, found myself in some pretty unfriendly situations. And you know, it was just sort of on the wrong track. Didn't really know who I was, where I was going, why I was here, and was always searching for that, you know, that thing to sort of reunite or reconnect me. And, you know, when I first stepped onto the yoga mat, there was just a huge affirmation. The yoga practice was what I've been looking for this whole time, and yoga sort of reminded me of, you know, just to breathe, to be present, to really be in my heart. That was just a huge realization for me.
Do you remember what the first time was, when it first occurred to you that you could make rap music, hip-hop music, based in yoga?
My wife and I, Amanda, have a yoga studio in Northern California up in a small town called Point Reyes Station, which is about an hour north of San Francisco. And it's called Yoga Toes Studio. And we actually got married in the studio. And during the reception, we had, you know, a big celebration, family, friends. And one of my good friends, Ross Evans, was dancing to we had the Beastie Boys was playing Brass Monkey, which is, you know, one of my favorite hip-hop songs of all time. And while the song was playing, Ross started pointing toward this statue of Hanuman, which is, he's a brass monkey, and he was on the altar. And I sort of had a light bulb moment. I was like, wow, you know, this is the culture I grew up with, and I'm really sort of hungry. I really have this strong desire to hear the messaging of yoga that's really conscious, that's not, you know, negative or violent or derogatory toward women, because I still love hip-hop culture. You know, the breakdancing, the graffiti, the MC, just the whole vibe is just so, it's so powerful, it's so uplifting. So when I had that sort of light bulb moment of integrating the yoga tradition into the hip-hop culture, it was a huge flash in my mind. And, you know, it was at our marriage, so it was literally wedding these two things that I love so much.
Well, we have to play some of Rock on Hanuman.
All right.
One of your most famous songs.
Hanuman G, son of the wind, lord of the monkeys, Rama's best friend. You eliminate illusion and destroy all sin, and you're known as Shiva's incarnation. You're the champion of truth with the thunderbolt body, the mighty monkey god who embodies bhakti. You're the breath of Ram, prana shakti. You achieve victory like the movie Rocky. You carry a club, dismantle.
Well, that song we recorded with Krishan Das, who is an amazing kirtan singer. Kirtan is a form of call and response chanting that comes from India. And one of the reasons why I love kirtan so much is because it's very similar to hip-hop. You know, when you go to a hip-hop concert, you know, the MC or the DJ often goes, say ho, ho. And so we just kind of flip it and we say, say om. So it's sort of that same, it's the same vibe, you know, getting people sort of engaged. And what I love about kirtan is it's not just about the artist. You're not just going to watch someone perform, but it's about everybody. It's about the community. And Krishan Das is an incredible kirtan artist, and I had an amazing opportunity to collaborate with him on this song, Rock on Hanuman. I also got a great chance to collaborate with Jayutal, Bhagavan Das, who are also incredible kirtan artists. And for me, when I first came to yoga, these were the guys that I was listening to. So to be able to work with them was just a huge honor.
A lot of your songs, like Rock on Hanuman, but there are a bunch of others, I guess you're partly using a lot of Hindu mythology and telling these wonderful stories about the great Hindu gods and goddesses. Are you meaning some of this to introduce young Western audiences to Hindu religion?
I consider my version of the myths to be sort of the comic book version, because I grew up reading comic books and watching cartoons. And, you know, for me, that was my education, because I pretty much flunked out of high school. I was not really engaged. The subject matter wasn't very inspiring to me. I didn't feel like I was very connected. And comic books became my teachers. And, you know, watching cartoons, you know, sitting in front of the TV, a lot of us grew up that way. And so for me, sort of weaving these myths into the hip-hop style. And, you know, I also am a graffiti artist and a graphic designer. So my version, I feel like it's sort of it's for the kid in all of us. And it is a real simplified version, because I want to speak in a language that everyone can understand.
There's another track you've got called Ganesh is Fresh. Where does that one come from?
Ganesh is Fresh. Well, Ganesh is such a beautiful embodiment of, you know, sort of the rich wisdom that the yoga tradition has to offer. I mean, every inch of Ganesh is symbolic for us as yogis. His long flowing trunk reminds us to breathe deep. His big floppy ears remind us to listen. His little eyes remind us to stay focused. You know, his big belly reminds us to really swallow and absorb our experiences. But he's also very light. He rides on this little mouse, so he's this huge creature, but he's also very lighthearted. He's very joyful. And for me, that is so fresh.
Ganesh is so fresh, chilling on his throne, surrounded by incense, fruit and gold, with a heap of sweets piled in his bowl. He guards the gate and protects the threshold. When you're blessed by Ganesh, then you can travel on a sacred journey to an inner temple. He paves the path that leads to your soul, and he's known for removing all obstacles. Now some may think it's illogical, a myth or just philosophical, but Ganesh makes everything possible, because elephant power's unstoppable.
Huge ally on the path. He's taught me a lot how to get out of my own way. In life, the biggest obstacle is always ourself. So Ganesh is not only the remover of obstacles, he is considered the obstacle itself. So when you're right up against it and you're struggling and it feels like you're right in the thick of it, it's like there's a huge elephant in the way. And that elephant is, you know, your own mind, your own perceptions, your own beliefs. And just remembering to breathe deep, to drop back into the heart, to listen, to be in the moment, to be present, to remember that life is truly sweet. You know, it's a blessing and a gift. Then the path starts to open up and we can flow with grace again. So for me, the word fresh means to be, you know, really present. Because when something's fresh, it means it's right now. Yoga teaches us that the only way you can really experience yoga is right now in the present moment. So Ganesh is a great reminder of that.
So do you think this is a direction that hip-hop music is moving? Because it had its origins in music that tended to be much more misogynistic, often glorified, you know, money, sex, violence, or at least that's what critics of hip-hop still complain about. Is it moving in a more devotional direction?
Well, hip-hop also originated, it was born in the Bronx, and it came during a time where there was, you know, really intense poverty in New York, and hip-hop was a way to bring community together. I mean, hip-hop artists would literally go out into the park with their huge sound system, and, you know, it was a way to sort of deter people from gang culture. That's where breakdancing came from. You know, instead of fighting, people started dancing and you know, channeling that aggression and that energy. And the same with rap battling. And so, yeah, hip-hop sort of veered in that sort of overly masculine direction, but so did our whole culture. And hip-hop is always a reflection of where we're at. So do I think hip-hop is going to be more devotional for myself? Yeah, because that's where I am. So I feel like hip-hop is always going to be a reflection of where we are as a culture. And, you know, I hope, I pray that it becomes more devotional and more community-based and gets back to its roots. And I think that I could definitely see that happening.
Was there one more song you want to choose to take us out with?
Let's play Be the Change, the story of Mahatma Gandhi.
Oh, I love that one. You want to tell us something about it?
Well, Gandhiji has always been a real incredible role model for me. And we all need role models. We all need people that we can aspire to be like. And in yoga, they talk about the Sangha, about surrounding yourself with like-minded people, people that really create that supportive atmosphere and environment for you to rise into your own greatness. And when I first started practicing yoga, I was reading a lot of books, and I read Gandhi's autobiography. And when I was traveling through India, I had the opportunity to spend time at his ashram and really see how Gandhi lived, which was, you know, he was really the father of the Indian Revolution, but he was also a huge proponent of sustainability before that was popular or even cool. He was talking about organic living and not living beyond our means. And so, you know, for me, Gandhi is just a huge testament of how one person can create a huge change in the world, and to never underestimate the power that we have as individuals and as a community to really shift the direction of our culture.
Gandhiji was a very great leader, but before all that, he was shy and meager. As a young child, he was just like you and me, before he became Mahatma Gandhi. The word Mahatma, it means great soul, and it's inside of us just waiting to unfold. If you follow your heart and act real bold, next time it'll be your story that's told. You gotta be the change that you wanna see in the world. Be the change, just like Gandhi. Be the change that you wanna see in the world. Be the change, just like Gandhi.
So when you play this song at any of your concerts, what's the mood like? What's the reaction like?
You know, it's one of my favorite songs to perform because, you know, when it gets to the climax of the song and people are chanting the chorus, which we turn it into an affirmation, I am going to be the change that I want to see in the world. The air is electric. It's like the air is just charged with light. I mean, I feel Gandhi's presence.
I regard myself as a soldier, though a soldier of peace.
MC Yogi's CD is called Elephant Power. He spoke with Anne Strangechamps. To find out more about MC Yogi's music, stop by our website. It's ttbook.org. You can become a Facebook fan of To the Best of Our Knowledge there, too. Just follow the link. Later this hour, rethinking the life of the Buddha.
The Buddha makes fun of our obsession with metaphysics. He says this is irrelevant. What matters is the question of the suffering that we experience moment to moment in our own lives, in the life of the world, and how can we respond to that?
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Stephen Batchelor wants contemporary Buddhists to rethink the life of the Buddha. A former Buddhist monk who was once part of the Dalai Lama's inner circle, Batchelor began an intense period of questioning how Buddhism was taught and practiced. In his new book, Confession of a Buddhist Atheist, Batchelor says a close examination of early texts about the Buddha's life reveals a man concerned about the present world, not older doctrines about karma and the afterlife. Steve Paulson asked him what we need to know about the life of the Buddha.
Well, you see, I think the mythic account we have of the Buddha, namely this young man who grows up as a prince and then goes outside the city walls and sees the corpse and the sick person and then renounces life as in the world and then becomes, after a number of years of practice, the Buddha. That, I think, is a very powerful myth. And I'm not trying to suggest that that myth has no value. But what it obscures is the sense of the Buddha as a human being, like ourselves, a human being who not only struggled to become the Buddha, but once he became the Buddha, was then in the position of having to establish his teaching, establish his community, and do so in a highly specific social, political, economic environment, that of 5th century BC India. And I find that in my research through the Pali Canon, which are the earliest bodies of texts we have in the Buddhist tradition, it came to light that there was, in fact, a very detailed account of the Buddha's life after the awakening until his death, and an account that shows that his work was not that of a detached monk living in a forest meditating all the time, but rather a person who was deeply involved in the political, social events and issues of his day.
And one of the points you make in your book is that he had to deal with these political realities. He couldn't just go off into the forest with his followers because there were local power lords or kings who controlled these areas. And he basically had to, I don't want to say curry favor because that might be not quite accurate, but he had to strike deals with them and win their trust.
That's correct. He had to deal with the complexities and the conflicts and the contradictions of the world. I don't think it's entirely incorrect to say that he had to curry favor. He needed to have the security and the access to wealth that would enable him to establish his community. He couldn't just wander off into the forest and just live off berries. He was involved in a project that entailed his dealing with some pretty violent and pretty awful people. But he had to depend upon these people because they were the ones who called the shots. If he didn't have the support of these kings, he would have no foundation for the work that he wished to establish or the community, the teachings he wished to establish in the world of his time. And so I found in exploring the Buddha's life in this way, this person became so much more real for me. And that also implied that the teachings he taught were not just about detaching oneself from the world, but actually were just as much about how to live in the world, how to deal with conflicted situations, how to deal with difficult, violent people. And that I found very moving and very inspiring, because that's the kind of world we live in today. And it shows that the Dharma is very much about engagement. It's about being in this world in a radically new way.
But the big questions, I think, for Buddhists today is what the Buddha himself thought about the great metaphysical questions. Is the universe eternal? Are people reborn? Is there some sort of cosmic consciousness? Do we know what the Buddha thought about these things?
No, we don't. All we do know is that he felt that to pursue such questions was irrelevant. That he listed, and you find this again and again in the early texts, he lists a whole bunch of questions, like the ones you just mentioned. And he says that to lose oneself in argument and concern for such things is a bit like a person who's been wounded by a poisoned arrow, who refuses to let someone take the arrow out until he knows the name of the man who shot it, the kind of bow he used, and so on. The Buddha makes fun of our obsession with metaphysics, with questions such as, are the body and the mind the same or different? Are we born after death or not? He says this is irrelevant. What matters is the question of the suffering that we experience moment to moment in our own lives, in the life of the world, and how can we respond to that in a way where we can realistically hope to diminish it, perhaps even to eradicate it. That's all that really matters. The Buddha is a therapist. He's a pragmatist. He's concerned with making a difference here and now in the quality of our life. All other metaphysical considerations are beside the point.
Now, as you know, there are critics to yeah. what you're saying. And uh-huh. I talked with one of them recently, Alan Wallace, someone you've known yes. well, another ex-Buddhist monk who's now a prominent American Buddhist, looking into the connection between science and Buddhism. And I want to play an excerpt from that interview that I did. I asked Alan Wallace about your previous book, Buddhism Without Beliefs, and one passage where you say, "The Buddhist was not a mystic. His awakening was not a shattering insight into a transcendental truth that revealed to him the mysteries of God." I asked Alan Wallace, so, you know, are you just wrong? And here's what he said.
I've known Stephen Batchelor for almost 35 years. We were monks together for years, both in India and in Switzerland. I think to come up with this picture of the Buddha, you have to bring out a carving knife and chop off great sections of the most, how would you say, authentic accounts we have of the Buddha's own teachings. You just simply have to ignore and pretend he never said an enormous amount of things he did say. So I think basically Stephen, my dear friend, I think he's recast Buddha in his own image as an English skeptic who is raised in an agnostic background, who really doesn't believe in anything non-physical, and he's basically casting his projection 2,500 years ago to India and saying, well, the Buddha was really like me, but a little bit better.
So you're saying forget about trying to strip Buddhism of its transcendentalism. I mean, that's part of Buddhism. And, I mean, you haven't quite come out and said it, but don't try to say that Buddhism is not a religion.
Well, if we come back to Buddhism without beliefs, what Stephen has done is he's given Buddhism without Buddhist beliefs and substituted for them the beliefs of scientific materialism. Buddhism, certainly from its beginning, has always had religious components to it.
Okay, I have to turn back to you now. Are you mired in your own dogma of scientific materialism?
Well, possibly I am. I don't know. No, I respect what Alan says. That is a perfectly, you know, respectable point of view. But again, there's certain uncomfortable points there. He says, carving away parts of the most authentic accounts we have of the Buddha and so forth and so on. Well, he's not specifying what they are. Now, if we go back into the earliest texts, it's true. We do find passages where the Buddha speaks of rebirth and so forth and so on. But what I've been using as my working hypothesis, as it were, is what is it in the Buddha's teaching that is distinctively his own, something that we do not find in the Indian tradition of his time? In other words, ideas that were simply current in his period. The doctrine of rebirth, the ideas of karma, these were already around at his time, not developed in the way that they will currently appear in many more developed Buddhist schools, but nonetheless, that worldview was largely in place. Now, I would argue that the Buddha likewise was a creature of his time and his place. He embraced many of the views of ancient India, it would appear, or at least he utilized them within his teaching. And so, just as I perhaps am a creature of my time, a scientific materialist, if that's the word you wish to use, then the Buddha was likewise a creature of his. Now, what I think is incumbent upon us is to try to strip away all those elements in our own view, in the worldview of the Buddha's time, that are not essentially part of his primary message. Now, I mentioned before the business of how the Buddha rejected any metaphysical beliefs. This is repeated again and again and again and again in the early tradition. The example of the arrow and so forth and so on. So I don't think I'm saying anything that is not essentially a teaching that characterizes very distinctively the Buddha from the period of his time.
Does the authority of Buddhism have to come from what we know about the Buddha himself? I mean, as, for instance, Christianity derives so much from Jesus, which is why, of course, arguments about the historical Jesus are so loaded.
Well, I kind of think it does. I mean, of course, I'm fully aware of the fact that I am a Westerner. I am, let's say, a post-Christian secularist. But nonetheless, it's important for me, if I think of myself as a Buddhist, to have as clear a possible understanding of who this person, the Buddha, was and what he most likely would have said at his time. If I can't answer that question, then the Buddha really sort of fades out of the picture. And we find that the reason Buddhism failed in India in the end was because it had become too much like the prevailing Vedantic Hinduism of medieval India. So I'm seeking to recover what seems to lie at the root or the source of the Buddha's teaching, and I agree, I admit that in doing so I'm going to bring my own biases and my own preferences and my own questions to this endeavor, but then I can't honestly see how you could do it otherwise. And likewise, Alan, too, will come from his own perspective. He will have certain views or beliefs that he can't perhaps, justify, but feels as a Buddhist, as a person of faith, that these are non-negotiable axioms that he has to hold to. I guess I'm in a similar position, and I think it's very healthy, really, as Buddhism tries to find its way in the modern world, as it seeks to negotiate modernity, that it does generate these sorts of differences and arguments and different perspectives. I think this is a sign of health. Now, I don't know the future. I can't predict which particular thread within this discussion will prevail, if any of them will prevail. But I do feel that I'm part, as Alan is part, of an ongoing dialogue, an ongoing discussion, in which we're really trying to get to grips with what this Dhamma is really about.
Stephen Batchelor is a former monk in the Tibetan and Zen traditions. His latest book is called Confession of a Buddhist Atheist. Steve Paulson spoke with him. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you want to hear this program again, check an author's name, or find out about a piece of music we used, visit our website. It's ttbook.org. To buy a copy of the program, call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 74A, New East, Old Wisdom. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Veronica Rickert, with help from Mary Lou Finnegan, Anne Strainchamps, Doug Gordon, and Charles Monroe Kane. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.